Good morning, diners and travelers. Welcome to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And good morning, Peter.
Good morning. Good morning. We have some continuity from last week's program to this week's program. But before that, we have a couple of special messages.
Yes.
Appropriate to Valentine's Day, and in one particular case, also an event that we think you ought to have on your calendar.
Yes.
And starting off, because that's one of the most exciting things in the food and wine scene coming up in the next couple of months, is what we consider to be probably the overall most comfortable and interesting food and wine festivals across the country. Comfortable because it's not so crowded. Comfortable because it's in Charleston, South Carolina. It's coming up at the beginning of the month of March, and we've featured them before, but they had a couple of special events that they wanted to talk to us about, so On the Menu caught up with them a few days ago, and we're bringing them to you at the start of today's program.
If you've been following On the Menu, you'll know that we're planning on attending the fourth version of the Charleston, South Carolina Food and Wine Festival, dates being March 5th through the 8th. And online today, we have Erica McMillan from the festival and Chef McKee from Oak Steakhouse. And they're going to tell us about two very special new events which are in the program on, I believe, the Saturday night, the 7th of March. Am I correct there, Erica?
Yes, Saturday the 7th.
And one's called Legends of the Something and the other's called Pinot Envy. Both sound so seductively attractive. Sure, it's something people are going to want to pay attention to, but you're going to hear it from the people who are really doing the events, because Brett's going to be cooking. Bob Wagoner and another of his colleagues are going to be cooking together, might also be coming in before the end of this interview. Who wants to pick it up?
The two events, the first that Brett's here to talk about, which we're so excited about, is the Legendary Evening in the Lowcountry. It is new to the festival schedule this year. It is really going to be one of our very most unique events that we're having. Local chefs, Brett McKee from Oak, Bob Wagoner from You Cook With Bob, and Frank Lee of Snob. Three of Charleston's most celebrated chefs will be putting on a five-course dinner with Rick Tremonto of True in Chicago.
Oh,
and
fabulous.
Talk about all of the amazing food that is going to be happening.
Is Gail Gann from True coming down as well, or just Rick?
No, just Rick will be here. Gail's not coming this year.
Okay, Gail was on Menu just a few weeks ago talking about her new cookbook.
Yes, she was here last year.
Okay, well, we weren't there last year. We had a good excuse. We were in Australia. But Brett, tell us about what's cooking with this wonderful event.
All right, let me tell you a little bit about the menu. The great thing about this event is, I do all of these events all over the country, and you're always at big events where you're just walking by and you're seeing the chef, but you really don't get up close and personal. So the idea I have behind doing this year is, you've got 40 people. The house that we're doing it, it's an old church in the old village of Mount Pleasant that was turned into a private residence. The kitchen is right in the middle of the room where the event is going on. So here's an opportunity for 40 people to get up close and personal with the three local culinary legends in Charleston, Rick Tremonto, these two guys from Brooklyn who came down. They own a bakery called Baked, and again, they've been on Martha Stewart, so anytime you want good New York pastries, these guys are now bringing it to Charleston. The woman who owns the house, she has been in the restaurant business. Her kitchen is designed unbelievable. So here you have an opportunity as a guest to come up and really be a participant in not only the preparation of the food, to watch the guys all get together and put it out. So we're having champagne and hors d'oeuvres that we're doing before the event and an outside tent area in her backyard. Then we come inside for the dinner. We're doing Bob Wagoner, and he's, a culinary legend in Charleston, been around forever, has been at the Charleston Grill, and now has his own cooking show, Cooking with Bob. And he's going to do the pan-seared American shrimp over diver scallops with a little puff pastry and a Chardonnay and Ocetra cream sauce. And now, again, Erica can talk a little bit about the wines, but I'll tell you, the great thing about this, I do a lot of these dinners where you have a food and wine pairing. Just the selection of wines alone is worth more than the money that these people are paying for this. You get a flight of three different Chardonnays. You get Jordan Vineyard. You get Truchard Vineyard. You get Pine Ridge.
That's just with
the first course. So you get Bob's food, then you get three courses of wine. The second course, of course, I'm prejudiced. I think it's going to be the best.
This wouldn't be your contribution by any chance.
I'm telling you, man. We go into the Carpaccio beef tenderloin, a little bit of micro arugula sprouts, shaved black truffles, white truffle oil, a little crostini with Parmesan Reggiano. And here we have a library of offerings from Oregon Pinot Noirs, Archery Summit, Chehalem, and Sokol Blossary wines. And again, so you've got this nice light beef with the Pinot Noirs, two courses, six different wines, And that's just two of the legends. Then we go into Frank Lee.
Oh, okay. Frank. Okay. Say hi to Frank, by the way. He's an old friend. We really love him. The last time we saw him, he was in Greenville at the Snob. Was it the High Cotton in Greenville?
You know, Frank does a great job. I don't know if we put this together as the culinary legend or the Old Forks of Charleston. you have Bob and Frank, and I have probably been around the longest here and the oldest one. But, Frank, you know, he's just a pioneer in the Maverick cuisine in the Southern style. So, again, he's going to do a little pan-seared palmetto squab, sautéed spinach, shiitake mushrooms, and a port wine sauce. And here we have another library of three different Robert Mondavi wines.
And then the guys
for all those listening, you've already got your champagne and hors d'oeuvres. The hors d'oeuvres are done by me, so I know they're great. Champagne you start off with. By the time you finish with my course and Bob's course, you got a good buzz on already. So anything after that is just delicious. Now we bring in our guest chef again. Food and Wine, Culinary Legend, Chef of the Year, James Beard Award winner, Rick Tremano from True in Chicago. And he's coming in with the little braised Illinois pork belly, duck fat poached turnips, sour cherry gastrique, and chitrons. And he's going with a flight of three different Cabernets. So now what are we up to? 12, 13, 16.
We
can't even count how many glasses of wine we're having.
We wish we were spitting earlier.
Better spend the night somewhere this night. And then we go to these guys, I'm the old Brooklyn boy who located down at Charleston. So these guys are great. Two guys who just came in from Brooklyn, Matt Lewis and Renato Portofio. And these guys are doing a kind of New York, Brooklyn-style bakery here in Charleston now.
They have a shop in Charleston now.
Right on East Bay Street. They just got done doing their first book. And, you know, when Oprah does one of her favorite things, these guys have been on Oprah. They've been on Martha Stewart. And so just an exclamation point of the night is you get these guys doing dessert. And this we're doing with a little nibbly, which is a little Moscato d'Asti. So we're going to have that little effervescent. And they're doing a little fruit oriented dessert.
Hold on a minute, Brett. Now, when you tell people that these guys from Baked have been on Martha Stewart and Oprah Winfrey, don't forget to mention they've also been on the menu too.
They were guests
a few weeks ago talking about that. They just produced a book about all their desserts as well.
See, so I don't even need to tell you how good these guys are.
Absolutely not. They sound absolutely.
To be able to get up close and personal with all of these guys in a relaxed atmosphere, a beautiful home, and then what we do when the dinner is done, we go back outside. I've got some local guys coming in to roll fresh cigars. We drink cognac, we drink champagne, but all of the chefs will stay, hang out in the backyard, and here's your opportunity to just volley back and forth with all of these culinary legends.
All right, Dan, it sounds like an absolutely wonderful time. Now, let's move to the other event, Erica, which is Pinot Envy.
Yeah, and one quick thing I do want to point out.
Please, go ahead.
About Legends Dinners, when we talk about all these fantastic flights of wine, it is in Mount Pleasant, but we have wonderful transportation being provided back and forth from Marion Square by Compass Transportation. That is included in your ticket price, so your evening is just taken care of all around. It's going to feel like a very personal, intimate meal with friends. So we certainly, tickets are still available online, and we hope people come check it out. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Okay, now Pinot Envy sounds like fun, too.
Pinot Envy is going to be fun. A little bit different, you know, not as intimate, 300 of your closest friends, but this is also in Mount Pleasant. It is at a building, Bridgeside Events. It is going to hopefully, weather depending, take place outside on the patio, which overlooks all of most of downtown Charleston. It's right on the water. This event is new this year. Again, we're trying to focus on some more wine-related events. This will feature 16 different Pinots, so that's why we're calling it Pinot Envy Uncorked, all being poured on-site along with smoked seafood, fish, and then hand-rolled sushi. It's going to be a take on the wine camps that happen in Oregon. Little different because obviously ours is not going to be a week long, but there will be fire pits and water, so we're hoping to really invoke that atmosphere that is more of a Charleston style, but still a really amazing opportunity to taste a lot of wines and to pair it with seafood by Crew Carolina.
Oh, great. That's the crew that owns Carolina and the Boathouse and a couple of other places?
Yes, and they are working with the Sustainable Seafood Initiative to prepare all of seafood fresh in Charleston. We get great seafood, so we're really excited about Chef Charles Arena and Brandon Flory of the Boathouse, and then Jeremiah Bacon of Carolinas will all be there. And then they're going to straight from the boat, which pairs wonderful with all the different varieties of Pinot. It's going to be what seems like a spectacular event, especially if the weather is nice. You're going to be outside and on the water, all of the things about that people love about Charleston.
Well, one of the interesting things for listeners is if you go to the OTM audio archive, you can you can actually hear interviews that we recorded with the chef from Carolinas, with the aforementioned Brett McKee, who, of course, is speaking to us again today. Bob Wagon has been on two or three times, I think, and frankly as well. So if you want to hear some more from the horse's mouth about the chefs who couldn't join us today, if you go to the OTM Audio Archive, then do a search on some part of their name using Internet Explorer, edit and find on this page, you'll be able to go and listen and hear what they had to say about what's cooking when they're at home in their own kitchens. But I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen listening, that Charleston's worth the journey. The restaurant scene is absolutely terrific, and this event is one of the best food and wine festivals we've ever been to, and certainly among the best organized. So don't miss the entire festival, February 5th through February 8th. And,
March.
What did I say? February.
I got
no brains today.
I'm so excited. You wish it was a month earlier.
There you go. Then we'd be missing it because we're going to be away. Just quickly give us the website, Erica, for the event, for the entire event, and then you just pick your way down to buy tickets for these particular programs if they're of interest to you.
Sure. All of our tickets can be found online by visiting charlestonfoodandwine.com. And that's spelled out one word. Tickets are available now, but most of our events will sell out ahead of time, so you won't want to wait. You can also call 843-727-9998, extension 4, and we're happy to help you in any way we can. Again, those events are Legendary Evening in the Low Country and Pinot and Beyond Court, among 50 others that we have going on that weekend.
Well, Erica and Brett, thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll see you in Charleston.
All right. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Well, talk about matters of the heart, right?
Indeed.
I mean, this is a heartfelt issue.
Yeah, heartfelt special message for Valentine's Day that someone brought to our attention, and we thought it was just such an intriguing story that
it's a wonderful story.
We had to share it with you, and at the same time as we share this story with you, let us wish the worldwide audience of On the Menu listeners a very happy Valentine's Day. Upcoming on the 14th, on the menu we'll be celebrating in London. We hope you'll be celebrating with the one you love wherever it is, and that you'll have as good a time as we're going to have. So happy Valentine's Day to all of you out there in On the Menu land.
And happy Valentine's Day to you too, dear.
Kelly McElerney is calling On the Menu Radio from California with an interesting story, a story that has a whole series of dimensions, but we're featuring the story in the run-up to Valentine's Day for a special reason. Kelly, why don't you just explain that?
Well, I think what makes us sort of unique as far as the Valentine celebration, our company, the winery located in the Napa Valley, is held in trust by a medical foundation that devotes all of its research to cardiovascular. So therefore, everything that we produce and sell, our net income goes to support their mission.
So this is called Have a Heart, Give a Heart, but it's really in spades, huh?
It is. I think we're one of the places where you can actually say drinking our wine is good, not only for your heart, but for many other people's hearts as well.
Now, we should quickly say, of course, that the flagship wines are all red.
Yes.
With all the good things that go along with that. What are they called? Polyphenols or something?
And reversitol.
Reversitol. Okay, there you go. So there's lots of reversitol, and we got a really nice shipment to try, and I was just telling Kelly just a few moments ago before we came on the air that we drank all of them except one,
I said that was disciplined as it is.
And that's the 1886 Cabernet Sauvignon, and there's something very special about 1886. Kelly, why don't you tell us that part of the story?
Certainly. Well, and you may recall also when you were looking at the bottle, it's a unique mold. It's a beautiful old world style. We were trying to tie together the history of our property, which starts with the date, 1886. And there was a German gentleman that came from Sacramento area to buy the land from the local Episcopal minister. And if you have a moment to visit our website, you will see the original building, which was constructed in 1886 by Bernard Ehlers, is the building that we still operate out of today.
Now, while you're mentioning the website, why don't you just spell it out for us?
It's EhlersEstate.com, and that's EhlersEstate.com. And we're a beautiful little parcel, about 40 acres, located just north of the town of St. Helena. And we do all of our farming. We're certified organic growers. We also employ biodynamic farming practices. But what really makes the property special, as I mentioned earlier, it's one of the few remaining properties tacked from the late 1800s. The people that were running the winery during Prohibition, two local brothers, the Dominguez brothers, were able to bootleg. And so many of us that still have buildings that are in a good state of repair were able to keep the property because of our predecessor's ability to bootleg.
Well, we'll whisper that word, huh?
Yes. Well, we celebrated the repeal of Prohibition this last December, 75 years.
Oh, that's amazing! Isn't that amazing? I never did quite understand what drove that original constitutional amendment through. But there's a bar in Washington, Pennsylvania, not far from where we live, called the 21st Amendment, which obviously celebrates the same thing.
That's a clever, catchy name for a bar. That's great.
I'm sure it's not the only one that's out there.
Probably not, but you have more history on the East Coast than we do out here. So.
Now there's an interesting multinational flavor. Because the original founder was German, Monsieur Le Duc, who bought the winery, I forget what year, you told me a moment ago and I've forgotten.
Starting in the 80s, correct.
In the 1980s.
Correct, 19, sorry, yes.
And he was undoubtedly French.
Yes, he was. And then you've got, as we were again talking, we've got our Italian winemaker, Massimo Di Costanzo. So we do have a lot of Europe going on here.
But how would you characterize the Ehlers Estate wines?
We really aspire to be known for our site-specific or terroir-driven wines. And back to that one wine that you mentioned, if I could walk through our portfolio quickly.
Please do.
Okay, so the 1886 is really the pinnacle offering that is most expressive of that site-specific winemaking style. And we have focused on a couple of different blocks within our 40 acres. We have a soil series that is at the base of the Mayacamas Range. We're on the valley floor, yet we are really quite close to the western hillside. And that soil series is called Perkins, which is sort of a highly touted soil series that's found in the Oakville region. And then we have on the back side of the parcel a small knoll with some elevation gain. And that soil series is Aiken, which is primarily found on the Howell Mountain Appalachian. So we source most of the cab for the 1886 from these two blocks, and it's definitely a wine stylistically that can be enjoyed in its youth, but as you indicated, it will definitely benefit from some cellar aging as well.
Now it's definitely a premium market wine. Are there a couple of wines that are perhaps slightly better known that you would say it's sort of like this?
I would think sure. Spotswood comes to mind immediately because these again are wines that are highly representative of the terroir and the site specific wine growing that we believe we do just as well. And I would also put into that camp some of the Duckhorn cabs that are estate designated and vineyard designated. I would put into that camp Araujo, for example.
You've pictured it just perfectly for me, and I think any California fan will be familiar with these other names and will be able to associate and say, now I know which part of my cellar it belongs in.
Well, we hope that we eventually can be just touted on that list.
Oh, sure. I mean, I think that's true, but I have to admit, I mean, I think I know my California wines fairly well, and Ehlers Estate was not on my radar screen. I had not heard of it. It doesn't mean that you did a bad job or that I did a bad job. It's just that there's a name that needs to be made here, and I hope we're helping with that. And the unusual aspect of of the Leduc, if you like, the legacy.
Right.
Which is that the entire property is run for the benefit of research into cardiovascular disease is really a terribly important thing to happen, because it really is the national killer of the largest quantity of Americans and the largest quantity of people in many other countries around the world. So the association with red wine and the good resveratrol that it has in it is a great thing. But going beyond that and saying, I'm going to make the biggest contribution that I can to dealing with this heart disease problem, is certainly putting your money where your mouth is, as my mother would say.
Yeah, we're very pleased. And I do want to be quick to point out, though, that the foundation really is funding amazing research on the university level. So, ironically, the fact that they have a winery in their portfolio, that isn't even the type of research that they engage in. So they're really looking towards genetic predisposition for heart disease and what they can do to reverse that and actually alter the outcome of people that may sort of come into the game at a little bit of a deficit for whatever gene pool that they inherited. So it's really profound, the research that they engage in.
Now, we, of course, we quickly consumed the other bottles and the shipment that you sent, but go over those for us as well, if you would, please.
So again, the property is about 40 acres, and it is comprised of Bordeaux varietals. We grow mostly Cabernet, about 20 acres is devoted to that, but then we produce a varietal Merlot, which always has a bit of Cabernet and Cabernet Franc blended back in. And it's more, we position it as a Cab Lover's Merlot. I think, unfortunately, Merlot has taken kind of a beating over the last few years. But if you are a consumer that likes a really fruit-forward, rich, some nice oak elements framing the center core of the fruit, our Merlot is something to be considered. It's not a light aperitif style Merlot. You really can pair it with food. It's got a nice acidity profile. So it's a fine Merlot for many different occasions. We also produce, which is quite fun for us, a Cabernet Franc. And that has been traditionally 100% Cabernet Franc used from the excess on the blending from the Merlot and the Cab. And it's also just a very different style. It's not quite as green as many people might imagine a Cabernet Franc could be. We're in a very warm growing area, so it has sort of a spicier element, quite frankly. A little bit of a white pepper, and I like there's also a floral component on the aroma that is distinctive and, again, not necessarily what you would expect from a Cabernet Franc.
It's like the denser varieties of the red wines from the Loire, where Cabernet Franc, of course, is the red grape that's used.
Right.
So it's a little bit like a Sambuca Champigny or a Chignon or something like that.
Correct. I think, though, because, again, of our warm growing climate, we actually do taste every other Friday here at the winery, and we did do tasting of Chignon, and it was very fun to see the similarities, but also some significant differences between the growing regions are so different.
Sure, I'm just trying to give people who would pass Cabernet Franc from California by, give them a hook to hang it on that says, among the wines you will have tasted and probably enjoyed, here's something that's very similar. In fact, I can recall having a wine from Anjou, from the Angevin region, which fooled everybody in our blind tasting pool.
Okay.
with the strength of the wine, and no one imagined it could possibly be from the Loire Valley. Surely had to be from the southwest somewhere.
Oh, that's so fun to do that in a tasting, too.
Now, are you up to anything new? Are you doing more of the same, or do you have some new wine adventures for people who are following your wines?
Well, the one thing that we do, which is also very fun, we have a wine club, and we devote every year a blend, it's a Bordeaux blend, to a wine club offering that's exclusive to that group. And what I think is really great is the name of the wine is, and let's hope that everybody can kind of see the tie-in on this, the wine's called 120 over 80.
I got the message.
You got the message. So we have our offering this year, and it is, as I mentioned, a Bordeaux blend. So for us, the fun part about this particular product, it's something that you shouldn't be too analytical over. It's something that is really to remind us that wine should be enjoyed on a daily basis. It should be enjoyed food and friends and family and around the table. And so we don't want people to take this wine from an academic perspective, but really just feel good about opening it and sharing it on your daily table.
Well, it'd be a good wine to have for Valentine's Day as well, I guess.
It is, but I you know, shudder to mention it too much because it is an exclusive offering through the club.
Okay, so you have to go to Ayla's Estate and you have to sign up.
You do. You can do that through our website as well. But if you're looking for a good wine for Valentine's Day for the local market availability, I would definitely seek out the Merlot. And then as a gift, as I said, the bottle for the 1886 is just a stunning package, and the wine itself is quite extraordinary. So it's fun.
Well, Kelly, I really appreciate your joining us. Again, listeners, this is a special Valentine's Day message for the one you love, who is perhaps long enough along in years that heart disease might be an issue, or they're genetically predisposed to it, or you just want to do a good thing and enjoy giving something through the foundation, cardiovascular research, because it just seems like the right thing to do.
Thank you. Could not have said it better.
Kelly, thank you so much for joining us, and you're on our list for a visit the next time we come to California, which will certainly be before the year is out.
We look forward to it. It's a beautiful property, so we much welcome your visit.
Well, thank you to the LeDuc Foundation and to Ayla's Estates. Once again, Kelly, thank you for the information, and I certainly enjoyed talking to you.
You as well. Have a wonderful afternoon.
Bye.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're asking again that you email us so we find out what you're thinking. The address, onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com.
There you go. We love to hear from you. And to repeat the message before the commercial break, we also wish you a very happy Valentine's Day next Saturday.
Right. And we're moving right along. We have made a new discovery. I mean, after a while, new discoveries are kind of surprising.
Yeah, but there are always new discoveries in the city of New York,
yeah.
Where we were, of course, in last week's program. But there were several interviews that we held over until this week. The first, certainly intriguing, hidden away at 6th Avenue and 44th Street in Manhattan, as you'll hear.
Well, it's not exactly hidden away.
Well, it's somewhat hidden away because it's surrounded by tall buildings, and it's really a rather small, elegant space.
What a remarkable experience
we had. The story of Sushi Zen, anyway, comes out over the interview, so let's just listen to our words with the chef.
On the Menu has found a new favorite. We are in Sushi Zen in Manhattan, talking to a chef named Toshio Suzuki, who was described to me as the best sushi chef. I've said that fast four times. you're never likely to have heard about. And I had not heard about you, but I could tell just meeting you, chef, that you not only are experienced, but you are very wise. Welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you very much.
Now, You've had a long history. First of all, to be a sushi chef, it takes 10 years of training, which you did in Tokyo.
Yes, at least, yes.
At needed. Least 10 years.
10 years necessary.
Yeah, and then you really are credited with introducing authentic sushi into the U.S. through New York City.
Yes, that's true.
Now, tell us, when you first started, you didn't find an audience of diners ready to eat raw fish, did you?
Well, no, I didn't eat it.
Uh-huh. So, but everyone's come around?
Well, actually, I ate only, the cooked fish, in New York
okay.
City. I never saw their live or fresh, fish.
Uh-huh. Mm. Now, you weren't sure that you were going to be a chef at all because you wanted to be a Buddhist monk because you like to study philosophy, I understand.
I like it. They're both.
But you still do study philosophy.
Yes, still studied.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to, still to be, monk.
Ah, now, yes. Tell me about, don't go off to be a monk before we get to taste this wonderful sushi. Tell me, what is the connection? Because you say Zen means something in Buddhism, and there is a connection between sushi and Buddhism tenets.
Yeah, well, actually, I respected the one of monk, which Dogen monk. He created the vegetarian, you know, the discipline for, and also the same monk, you know, they practiced the meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So during that time in the kitchen, the same student working for their meal. So they say they have to worry about the their, you know, condition, body condition.
Healthful.
And do not give them so much, because if they eat too much, get sleep. So like a portion, like a medicine, you know. So that is a rule. I mean, he created the discipline, which the five colors, like a black, white, red, green, yellow, all those colors, you know, things is good for health.
Makes
the
balance.
Now. Exactly.
And now they find out that they are.
Yes. And also the five way to cook, like a saute, you know, steam, grill, steam, and raw.
Mm.
That is that. And also the sweet, salt, sour, and the bitter.
Umami.
Yeah, umami. That's right. You got it. That's right. They are very interesting about it. So that's why they served like three conditions of the rule, which is good. And that is always concern about their physical condition is good for food. And mental, you know, is good too.
Right. Now, I understand reading this information that you like to consult when somebody's doing an omakase, which means chef's choice.
Mm-hmm.
Before you decide what you're going to serve someone, you want to talk to that person about likes and dislikes and also about how they feel that day. So, I mean, if somebody's really tired, is there a particular food you would give them?
Oh, yes, I do. Like a warm, you know, thing. Because this is a restaurant, a sushi restaurant,
no.
So it has a limit. It's not like a doctor. But this makes the more, like, what's called, comfortable serve, you know, I do. Like when they get tired, so need some kind of warm, you know, things first. And to make the stomach, you know, conditions good.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
Yes, and then started the raw fish, something like that. So always, you know, look careful their person condition.
Now, you do a number of things here. You do appetizers. Mm. You do regular sushi. You do an omakase, which we said is your choice, a whole series of dishes.
Mm.
You also do a kaiseki.
Yes.
And what is that?
Kaiseki, that's the monk Dogen created the vegetarian. And the kaiseki is, kai is like a inside of, you know, what's called it. When the meditation, they get a little cold. So under here, around here, put the, some kind of a stone, you know, the baked stone wrapped fabric and put it in. You know, like a steamer.
Uh-huh.
What to call it? Steamer? Is that right?
Steamer, I guess, yeah.
Yeah. So that much things, you know, small portion.
What I understood was it's sort of related to the tea ceremony.
Uh-huh.
Is that true?
Yeah, that is the
food part.
Food part, yes. For the good for the tea, you know.
Uh-huh. Very good.
And then century come this more than like 100 years later after Dogen appearing.
I see.
The Kyoto society, they accepted their idea.
Uh-huh.
So the few things, you know, for front of the customer.
Now, you practice a type called Edo.
Edo.
Mm-hmm. And that is like the most traditional?
Well, Edo is a new, modern, very modern, like three
modern.
Or 400 years ago, you know.
Oh, that's modern.
So, I mean, it's for, compared with the Dogen era. Dogen, was born about 800 years ago.
Mm. I see.
Yes. So the, you know, the Edo is an ancient Tokyo.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. Also, so that's, it's very traditional,
that's
though.
Right. Yeah. And the front of that Edomai is a Tokyo Bay, the front.
Uh-huh.
So like a New York Bay, you know, like that. You know.
Uh-huh.
So that's a Tokyo Edomai style.
Okay. Mm. Now, you are credited with introducing the roll when you weren't able to sell just your regular raw fish, sushi, you introduced people to the roll, and then when they complained that the seaweed was sticking to their lip, you put it inside and turned it into the inside-out roll. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. When I came here, United States, so I my business almost, you know, I get the back, the Chapter 11 here in New York.
Yes.
So the, I should search the customer, you know, the structure of a month.
Mm-hmm.
How? So if I serve it directly outside the inn, you know, the rolled sushi, the soon at the day at above here,
I know
month,
what you mean.
Yeah, sticked it. So they hate it like this, you know. So that's why I, you know, see the structure, the what the, you know, acceptable, you know,
and that's why you put
sushi.
It inside.
So that's, and also I saw the hamburger top, the sesame, you know, the.
Oh, right.
So I made it.
You put sesame
inside,
right?
Exactly, inside out and the sesame on it.
Oh, that's amazing.
So.
Well, you've
and
done
then
a great
business,
job. How
yeah.
many business, how many years have you been in business now?
20, coming six. Coming six.
And I wanted to mention that you also, I was very impressed with the fact that you actually mentored the Iron Chef, Morimoto.
Right.
And you said you could tell he was talented the minute you met him.
He does. He has. He's like my friend and the same, you know, what's called a philosophy, you
same
know, carry. So it's like a very close friend.
Well, what do you think we're going to eat? What do you think we will have with the omakase?
Oh, I like to recommend it, first of all, the appetizer, you know, and then sashimi, and a little warm, you know, pot. Maybe monkfish.
Oh.
How'd you like it? You like it? Maybe
good.
You like it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Monkfish
paper
liver?
Pot. Yes, serve it with a paper in a pot.
Uh-huh. Mm. And what is your signature dish? What's your favorite?
Here's
thing?
A sushi. Sushi.
Right. Any particular sushi?
Well, the fluke with sesame or toro, you know, the bluefin.
Right. Well, now I must say that listeners, that when you come into this place, it's really beautiful. It's not the hole in the wall. Mm. It's gracious, airy. Beautifully decorated. The tables are wonderful. And I'm expecting a wonderful meal. And we do have the manager here who is too shy to talk, he said. But he's responsible for giving you just about anything you want and making you totally comfortable. Is he going to talk?
What I wanted to add is the amazing thing is the location is so convenient. We're sitting 30 yards from 6th Avenue. On 44th Street, so it's walking distance from anywhere in Midtown Manhattan. I had never seen it before this morning when I checked out where I was as a red awning comes out into the street, but it's just about the most conveniently located restaurant in Midtown Manhattan that you could have. And perhaps you do have a website so people can get more information?
Yes, we do have it.
Well, we're going to get it in a minute. Oh, that's easy to understand. Then that's... www, of course, sushizen, all one word, -newyork.com. And listeners, your next trip to Manhattan, you absolutely should come by here. I said
sushi
that. I'm going to do it again because I supposedly did this wrong. It is, right. It's sushizen-ny. And that's what I did wrong. .com. That's good. Oh, and the website is being updated as we speak. Okay. Well, anyhow, I look forward, Chef. Thank you. Arigato.
You're welcome.
If the chef owner at Sushi Zen is one of our new friends, Brad Farmery, our next guest, is an old friend, and that'll be clear once you hear this interview, because not satisfied with having two restaurants already, he decided to open another one, and we went there, of course, and had a really nice time. And here's Chef Brad Farmery talking to us about the Double Crown experience.
We just had this fabulous tour of a new restaurant, well, new to us, called Double Crown. Our tour guide was Chef Brad Farmery, who's also a partner in this restaurant, and an old friend of On the Menus. You've heard him interviewed here before. Thanks so much for having us and for the tour, Brad.
Well, it's great to see you two again.
You have to start by telling us, I mean, there's so much of interest in this place, like all of your buildings. You'll remember, listeners, that we went through this with Public, which is filled with all these interesting details of concepts as well, because the partner is Averoco, which is a fabulous design company. Brad, tell us, first of all, how did we get started on... No, first tell us what the concept is.
The concept of Double Crown is a blend of British, Indian, and Asian influences. I lived in England for about 8 years, and so, you know, it's quite an interesting melting pot, especially in London. And you see a lot of these influences coming together and how they meld together to form a new cuisine. And so we wanted to capture that idea and bring it to New York City.
Now, this is larger than Public, you told me, but there's so many interesting little nooks and crannies here, hidden secret doors.
True.
Yeah. Where did you get all of these details? A lot of it, I understand, you actually brought from, or your brother did, or his partners did, from India, or where else?
From Thailand.
Thailand.
Chiang Mai and Bangkok, Hong Kong.
Some of them are, for example, look at these lanterns over this long, wonderful bar. You say they're hand-carved stone from India.
Yes. The most of the details that they brought back with them, you know, you would never be able to afford in America, let alone find in America. And so we want to, again, bring some of that culture, but not to try to make it an Indian restaurant or a Southeast Asian restaurant. It's still very much a Western restaurant with these as decorative nuances, almost like the way that we're using their spices or tandoori rubs as, you know, a finish to a very Western dish.
I mean, the neon sends a very clear message that this is not some stuffy old fuddy-duddy.
No. Also, when we...
I love the glass horses with the neon the ladies' room.
Yeah, they did a great job. They left exposed wires. They have some objects just leaning against the wall, so it doesn't look overly produced.
I said I didn't even notice that because that's what my house looks like.
Yeah, it is a very comfortable space. You know, people come in, they don't feel obligated to spend a ton of money, and they don't feel obligated to be overdressed. It's just a very, very fun night out.
And you have a private room?
A private dining room for up to 50 or 55 people, so it's a good-sized place. And then we also have sort of a secret hidden bar in the back that can have about 35 or 40 people there. So, like you said, lots of options for little locations.
And you have permit for outdoor seating?
Yep, and we can do about 40 people outside in the summer. So, we'd like...
Not today.
No, definitely not today. So, yeah, we like to break restaurants up into small little sections.
The secret bar you're talking about, is that the one called Madame Gustave's?
Madame Geneva.
Geneva. Now, what... Madame Geneva and Southeast Asia? You're going to have to explain that one.
Well, Madame Geneva was a slang term for gin in the 1800s from the UK. So again, we're taking our very basics from the UK and England. And there's about 35 or 40 gins that we serve back there. Even the cocktails that we make there are based on history as well. I guess back in the 1800s when there would be really low quality gin, they would stir in marmalade.
Ew.
So that you couldn't taste it. And so what we did was we took that idea and we make house-made jams with very low sugar, and we use that as a mixing agent for these 35 different gins that we've found. So.
Oh, so you have a big gin thing going here.
A lot of gin, yeah.
Talk to us about some of the menu items.
Okay.
You have starters. You have a lot of starters, so I think you can encourage people to come in and mingle and eat as much as they want.
We want people sharing and experiencing a lot of different types of food. So we made a whole section that is very small dishes. We call them hawker-style dishes, based on the hawker snacks of Singapore and the street food of India and Thailand.
How about an example here?
An example would be a pint of prawns, which is more of a British seaside treat. We do duck steam buns. So we make confit duck mixture and then put it into a very, very light steamed bun. And so in the appetizers, a good example of what we're trying to do here is the foie gras. What we do is we marinate it in a tandoori marinade, and then we poach it very, very slowly. And then we serve it with prunes that have been cooked in Earl Grey tea.
Oh, nice.
So you're getting a little bit of India and you're getting a little bit of England in a very, very delicious dish.
Is this something you've done before? Because I vaguely remember that you did this at Public, the smoked mackerel salad.
We do a lot of smoking. I'm cool things. I cure things and I smoke things. I tell my employees if they stop moving, they're going to get one of those treatments. So we smoke a lot of fish, and especially oily fish. And, you know, smoked mackerel is such a delicious treat. And
they're
smoked and pickled.
In England. I mean, if you buy the average market smoked mackerel in the U.S., it's
oversalted
and it doesn't taste very good.
It's not very good. So, yeah, we're looking at that British model. The same thing, we make what we call streaky ham.
Like streaky bacon, but streaky ham.
Exactly. We house cure it for about 10 days, cold smoke it, and then roast it and slice it very thin. So it's a belly cut like streaky bacon. So it's a nice mix of fat and meat and really delicious.
And what about mains? You have a whole bunch of those too.
Yeah, probably, one of the most favorite dishes is the big braised short rib. So we braise it in Guinness and five spice.
Oh, that sounds
good. Again, giving
the
East and the West the combination. And then two of my favorite vegetables, roast parsnips and Brussels sprouts. Whenever I have those, I think of my time in England because they were so popular over there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We love them, too.
Yeah.
Licorice, I have pheasant and licorice pie. Now, tell us about that.
We took the idea of a British meat pie, kind of mixed it with the idea of an American pot pie, and then threw the whole thing up in the air, and what came down was a pheasant licorice pie.
Is it like real unsweetened licorice?
Unsweetened licorice,
yeah.
So it's more
stuff from Italy.
Yeah, it's more of the anise. So again, you're getting hints of something interesting and Eastern.
Well, I'm really excited about this, and I look forward to trying some of this. Let us know what the location is. Specify that for this.
We are on the corner of Bleecker and Bowery, two major streets. And all honesty, I'm not even sure what the exact address is.
Well, here, Peter knows this stuff.
Well, it's only because I looked it up because I had to tell the cab driver. It's 316 The Bowery, and it's on Bleecker Street, right at the corner of the Bowery. Where else would it be? Now, Brad, we can't let you go without talking about the gin program and the wine program a little more, because we know you do wonderful things with the wine program at Public, so I'm sure you've got a wrinkle going here.
We do. Again, at Public, we focus primarily on Australia, New Zealand, and New World wines. The Monday Room, we focus on very hard to get unusual. People who have a real good wine knowledge love the list there, and so it's really unusual hand-picked wines.
And that's next to Public.
Yes. And then here, we focused on organic and biodynamic wines.
Oh, yeah.
Almost all of them are off the radar. So they're from unusual wine regions. Or they'll be Van de Pay. You know, they won't even be a classified wine because these winemakers want to work outside the system. Where it almost like a super Tuscan wine. You know, that's not necessarily the direction we're going, but people working outside the system yet doing extremely good wine. We also have an amazing sherry program and an amazing port program. Two things that are very popular in England. So we love pairing the dry sherries with a first course or a second course, and a lot of port to choose from.
And the gin, is it a lot of wacky cocktails?
There's some, again, using a bit of the tropics, but also using we've done a lot of the tropical stuff at Publix, so we're going more towards old-fashioned cocktails and kind of bringing that back a little bit.
How about the website?
Website is doublecrown-nyc.com. Right now it's very limited amount of stuff on the website.
Oh, but, I'm surprised because your website's usually pretty
good. I know. Yeah, compared to public, it looks very simplistic. But but I think, you know, that's kind of what we're trying to do with the image of Madame Geneva and Double Crown is keep it straightforward and simple. And I think people are interested in that right now.
Well, I'm really excited about it. And as I said, I'm excited to see you again because I hadn't seen you since you became a new daddy.
It's been a while, yeah.
Yeah. So, anyhow, daddy-o. Thanks for talking to us, and thank you for the tour. And I look forward to this.
Well, great. Enjoy your meal.
Thank you. I will, I'm sure. If you're taking care of it, I will. Brad, thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And it's break time once again.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're in for a treat now. We frequently get personalities, larger-than-life personalities on our show, and boy, you're now going to meet one of the iconic larger-than-life personalities, and this is Pino Luongo, and we love talking to him. I'm sure you're going to love listening to him. Ciao, Pino. Welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, we're going to be talking about your book, Dirty Dishes. It's sort of autobiographical, but it's also... It's a very smart chronicle of those years. What years are they in the restaurant industry in New York?
Yes, starting in 1980 all the way to now, today's days, basically.
Now, but if we just go all the way back, you started out as you studied acting in Italy. You started out in a small town. Tell us where, in the Maremmo.
Yeah, but when I was a young kid, teenagers, in the summertime, I was doing summer theater, mostly Greek tragedy, and doing The Messengers, the kind of kid that delivers the message. And just because I really want to be involved in theater, up until when I was time to go to college, and I went to Rome, and I become a member of the Fersen Academy, of Acting Academy in Rome, and eventually within a year, I start to professionally act in theater for 10 years. And I worked with some of the biggest Italian company and some of the biggest Italian actors as well. So my life was in theater up until the day that the military decided to renegade on my conscious objector application and tried to get me into the army, 2 years mandatory service back in 1980.
I gather you do not have much of a temperament for the military.
I did not, especially because coming from a military family, I grew up in a boarding school at the age of 11.
And you hated that.
In a military boarding school, and once I got out of that one, I said, never in my life I'm going to wear a uniform. So it's just against my DNA to really become a military. Yes, sir, no, sir, never apply to me too much.
I can't see it at all.
So instead of doing that, you set off with cento lire in your pocket and landed in New York, and you said you kissed the ground and said, this is where I'm going to be.
It was more than cento lire at that time, but the day that I was supposed to present myself for the 40 days military training camp, I actually landed in New York City. And when I was off this charter plane, I kissed the tarmac and I said, thanks to freedom, I'm here. And I was hoping that my status will correct itself within 6 months, like the lawyer suggested, and basically be able to go back to Rome with my own life. But quickly came to realize that I was going to stay here for a much longer period of time. So I started to look for a job. And the second thing that came to my mind, due to the fact that I didn't speak one word of English except a few words that I learned, which most of them are not really correct words to use, I really looked around for many different restaurants in Manhattan. And I was a little bit, out of water looking at these menus posted on the windows of many restaurants because I didn't identify anything that didn't make sense to me in terms of Italian cuisine. Up until the time that I ran into the window of small, tiny, great-looking restaurants in the village, and the menu basically was totally inspired by regional Italian cuisine, mostly Tuscan. And I enter, and I was lucky that the general manager was Italian. And within a 15 minutes conversation, I was offered a job as a busboy to start immediately, which basically meant the day after. And so I did. I roll up my sleeve. I swallow my tongue because I could not really use my Italian language to make a living with. And I went back and do a very humble job and a very pressured job of being a busboy in a very, very successful small restaurant in the village those days.
But now you had had restaurant experience through your uncle.
My restaurant experience was based working on in the summertime at my uncle's restaurants in Porto Santo Stefano in Italy. And yes, I.
And you learned cooking from your mother as well?
Well, my cooking always been part of me. You know, I was born, and cooking was the second thing I learned right after that. And my mother was a great master, a great teacher. Not really the kind of teacher that you expect with the warm and fuzzy guidance, but just, you know, keep looking at what I'm doing and you learn.
Yeah, well, you sure learned a lot.
Yeah.
And you built this career up to where you were actually top of how many, I mean, in your empire, how many restaurants were you operating and juggling at one time?
At one time, fortunately for me, were 23 restaurants.
That was terrible.
And it was an unfortunate thing because I became a restaurant junkie in the terms that my life was going from hopping from one plane to another, traveling all over the States, trying to put fires out most of the time. I'm really dealing with the pool management across the board because of my original restaurants, which there were only 9 of them, everything was fine. Most of them in New York, 2 in Chicago, and 1 in L.A.
Run through some of the names because I think that they have a major place in restaurant history.
But the one who plays a major, he had a very, very important meaning to me was my first one, which was in Cantinori on 10th Street in Manhattan.
And I told you that one of our earlier guests passed there and said to her daughter, passed the site, and said, this man was the first to introduce real, authentic, regional Italian food to New York City.
Yeah, that's true. That's what Cantinori, when I opened, I had the audacity to write on the menu and on the awning, Tuscan restaurants. And for 6 months, I was spending time to explain people calling me that it was not a Tucson restaurant, but it was a Tuscan restaurant.
Yeah.
And that was some. I knew that, you know, I was going to have an uphill battle to really overcome this misunderstanding.
Right.
Which eventually I did with the help of James Beard, which really supported my restaurants back in 1983. I was able to eventually succeed and really pursuing what I think the Italian cuisine is known to the Italian at best, which is the regional home cooking that can be regionally interpreted in restaurants in trattorias. And mostly it's based on ingredients, produce that really fly, run, or grow in within a 30, 40 kilometers area.
Uh-huh.
And you understand, as much as those ingredients are phenomenal, they are limited within the regionality. And if you go in Italy region by region, you find dishes that are so culturally and flavor-wise and taste-wise so far apart. And I always believed that that was the biggest strength of Italian cuisine.
Well, now people reading your book are going to recognize a lot of the people that you came across. I mean, the preface or introduction to your book is by Tony Bourdain.
Right.
Who you knew as, tell us what your impression of him was as a young chef.
I interviewed Anthony Bourdain when I was looking for a chef for a new New York restaurant called Coco Pazzo Teatro. Anthony was working as a line cook at Le Madre restaurant, and Le Madre is one of my top 4 or 5 restaurants that I ever built. And I interviewed him, and, you know, he was a chain smoke kind of guy, so him and I, we really got along immediately very well. And from the interview, I came to realize that besides having a talented chef, I was dealing with a talented person to begin with. His way of telling stories and explaining to me how he got into cooking and his personality made them a star to my eyes from the beginning. So I asked him to cook something for me, and he looked at me and says, "Don't you want, I hope you don't ask me to make pasta for you." I says, "You know what? Stay away from the pasta. Show me what else can you do it." And he made for me a phenomenal brandade. Yeah. And even though it was a French dish, it was so good that I said to him, "You know what? I'm going to Italianize you." Because you're definitely a Francophile kind of chef, and you and I, we're going to get along with that. So I took the job at Coco Pazzo Teatro, and we really were able to daily interact together very well, with only one problem. The problem was that, you know, Coco Pazzo Teatro, being in the Broadway district, always had this serious pressure that everybody would come for dinner between the hours of 5:30, 6 o'clock until 7:30. And the restaurant would have 180 diners that wants to eat and out of there in an hour and a half. That was something that really was Anthony's biggest, the weakest spot. You know, he could not deal with that pressure. He was concentrating on the quality of the food and not really realizing that time was going by. Many times I kind of get involved myself and went into the kitchen, expedite, and help him out, up until middle of July when I realized that this problem was never going to change. Mm-hmm. And I choose to tell him myself that, you know, there was no way they could be the chef any longer. So we went outside after the rush hour. We took a walk. We smoked a cigarette. And as very known penal issues, I was not able to tell him anything. I didn't tell him, you know what, give me your aprons, pack your stuff and leave. I actually smoked a cigarette, spoke about something else, and when we went inside, I grabbed the general manager and told him, you know, you got to tell Anthony Bourdain that this is last week.
So you finked out.
I kind of, I could not face the fact because I liked the guy so much.
But you're still good friends.
Oh, yes, we're still very good friends, and they still actually thank me for everything Italian that he learned, to the point that he met an Italian woman. So
that second wife was Italian.
And more importantly, because from being a big soccer fan of France, it turned into a big soccer fan of Italy.
Oh, now that's very important.
That makes a big difference. Now we can be almost called brother.
The calcio is really important.
Calcio, yeah. Yes,
yeah,
indeed.
Yeah, Anthony, yes. And you see, in Anthony's book, if you can see through the Kitchen Confidential, he talks about certain aspects of the restaurant industry as experience as a chef. My experience as a restaurateur was basically the good and the bad that come from basically running the old thing, from designing the restaurants, building the restaurants, planning the menu. At many occasions, in the first two or three restaurants, I was the chef de cuisine as well. And I really view the restaurant business the same way I used to view theater.
Is theater, right?
For me, it's theater.
You say that in the book. You say that.
Absolutely.
When you walk into a place, you could see the whole thing unfold.
Right.
Right. And even pulled the dames right out of the air.
Yeah. And, you know, the casting is made by my customers. The staging is my restaurants. And all we do is just directing the performance of the customers. And I developed this very quick, innate sense of spotting what goes wrong and what goes right, knowing that there is a rhythm in the way you serve the customer, in the way the food comes out. And when the harmony is perfectly in balance, doing restaurant business is a phenomenal, beautiful experience. Unfortunately, many times, there's always something happen.
You had some difficulties with, your investors had some difficulties, like the Pressmans.
No. The problem when I really start to get involved with corporate America, they thought that, you know, opening a restaurant was like putting a stamp on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And in reality, when they convinced me against my instinct to make this acquisition of this chain of restaurant called Sfusi, even though I knew that it was wrong because they were spread all over the country, they did not reflect the food that I want to do it, and the management style, I'm sure it was not my management style. And even though my instinct told me three times in the road, don't do it, eventually I was convinced to get involved, and 60 days into the acquisition, I start to really deal with the nightmare flying all over, put fire out, and then, of course, the investors, what they promised they were going to put back into the company never came through, and so my other concerts suffer as well. So basically a big nightmare started, and my experience was complete as far as American concerned. You know, I went from the American dream, and I experienced the American nightmare, and now I experienced the quietness and security and control of being owner of one restaurant only. I'm not the owner, but I'm operating this restaurant in Chantilly.
Yeah. And what does Chantilly mean again?
Chantilly means 100 lira, which was actually the price of a one-way ticket on a boat leaving Italy in 1910, 1920, and coming to America and to the land of opportunity for mostly southern and Italian men to look for a job. And this is a celebration of Italian cuisine compared to Italian-American cuisine, which I consider at this point the 20th region of Italy, Italian-American.
it's funny, you know, we forgot to mention at the beginning of this interview that what prompted us to invite you to join on the menu was that you, in fact, just completed your life story in a book called Dirty Dishes.
Oh, we didn't mention
Did we mention that?
Yes.
I thought we'd forgotten that.
We did mention Dirty Dishes, yes.
We did. Anyway, so the rest of the story is in the book, and Miss Anne doesn't read many books from cover to cover, but this is one that she couldn't put down.
Oh, well, they're all my acquaintances and friends and family, all these people involved, and I think most of our listeners will find that too. It's a whole era of the restaurant history in this country, in New York, and also about Italian cuisine and how we got to have some real stuff.
Yeah,
And I think you should, in addition to Chantilly, you should mention that you are not just going to stay with that one restaurant, right?
No, my desire is to expand again, and this economical environment, as tough as it is creating opportunities for new spaces to come available, and I definitely would love to expand in Manhattan again, at least have the opportunity to operate one or two more restaurants in the course of the next 1 or 2 years.
Yeah.
Because one restaurant for me is too tight. You know, I'm a Gemini. I need to really moving around and do more than one thing at the same time. But Dirty Dishes, I think that the validity of the book for the readers is that not only touch upon the whole sense of what the restaurant business is about, is actually take the point of view of someone who start from scratch, learn the financing behind opening the restaurants, learning how to operate the restaurants and make it profitable, and then create longevity. That's one component. That I was very successful at as an operator. As a financial guy, maybe in 1996 I should have known better, and I let corporate America convince me. But now we know what corporate America is all about, right?
We've seen the scandals
with the bank. We see the scandals with all of the bailouts the government is doing, and you know, I wonder if they're never going to bail out the small businesses, which they're the one who provide the largest amount of work in America,
right,
more than anybody else.
Yeah.
Chances are they will not.
Yeah. Now, I might mention that about this book is that people reading it are also going to have an opportunity to have some of their behind-the-scenes questions answered, such as, why is it you can't get a table, or why is it some people can get a table and others cannot? Also, you're just straightforward as all get out over your opinion of restaurant criticism in this country. And as a former restaurant critic, I can agree with you and enjoyed reading your comments. You're a very funny man as well.
Thank you.
Thoughtful and funny. And I love the book, and I hope that somebody will go on our website, and many will go on our website and just click onto it and buy it and read it.
Yeah, you know, and I'm wondering if the book has been sent to so many different journalists and reviewers, and I wonder if some people don't want to touch the book with a 10-foot pole just because I have an opinion about the press. And my statement is not by saying or attacking the press, it's by actually saying if there is a freedom of press or freedom of expression, I always been criticized, and the book speaks about that, about the fact that sometimes when I felt that comments or review were unfairly made, I sometimes reply and wrote a letter to the reviewer, and they always react like, how can you, how dare can you really write me back and criticize my point of view? Right. And, you know, when you write, you write, but when you're sometimes wrong or you don't really have the chance to really pick on what the restaurant is all about, it's my job, because my job is, as a restaurateur, is spending money, investing money, putting money at risk, working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. And, you know, sometimes it's very difficult to swallow a criticism that is being made in a 2 minutes flashback and just wiped out everything you work for it, because maybe people don't pay attention to some of the many details that goes into the restaurant business.
Right.
So that's my pet peeve.
What about, was it an English chef who decided to open himself to criticism? He invited all the media and he went in the kitchen and actually cooked, and it was awful.
But it was not my experience. I don't know
I read that somewhere. It wasn't in your book.
I think this was a recent.
Oh, it just happened.
It was a recent story in a blog, and it really was a comment about restaurateurs like Tom Colicchio, who who are never to be found in their restaurants. And I think it was about that, but someone had actually found an experience where somebody actually went into the kitchen, and it was his kitchen, and what came out was something that Gordon Ramsay would not have enjoyed.
Right, but Gordon Ramsay never enjoys anything. I don't even know if he enjoys breathing his own hair.
Well, he certainly doesn't do that, does he?
I mean, the guy basically decided to make a name for himself to be a nasty son of a bitch, and you know what? I really have a problem with that, so.
The funny part about it is, Pina, have you been to his restaurant?
I didn't like it at all.
You didn't?
Which one did you go to?
You didn't like the one on Royal Hospital Road?
In London.
No, the one in New York.
No, we didn't go there.
No,
London.
If you want to understand why he has the reputation that he has, you have to go to the original Gordon Ramsay on Royal Hospital Road, where the food is quite exquisite.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure that the one place, stand-up place, he can do very well. But what he's done in America for me didn't impress me at all.
No, I'm sure that he's sprayed way too thin.
And the same thing for the restaurants of Alain Ducasse. I'm not impressed by any one of them.
Right.
So, see, I spoke my mind, right?
There you go.
I welcome it. I think it's great.
I mean, which one?
No, I welcome that you speak your mind.
Yeah, I mean...
I don't want to talk to anybody who won't
speak. People always,
mind.
You know, sometimes there are people, you know, dismissing Italian food. Oh, it's comfort food. Should not even be part of judging the food. You know what? Actually, I think Italian food is the number one type of cuisine chosen by the American in this country.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think
and it's
right.
The most popular one. So it deserves certain recognition for what it does. And the fact that we are only doing real food versus creative food, it doesn't make Italian food any second-class type of cuisine.
No.
And, you know, that tells you by if you go by reviewer. When you are a French very good restaurant, they might consider 3 stars and up. When you are a very good Italian restaurant, you never go past 2. Maybe sometimes 3, but that's because you have to pull some string.
Yeah. Well, we actually know somebody who has a Chinese restaurant who finally got a Michelin star. That's rare too,
and we've been to several in Italy that actually have ascended to the heights of 3 and well deserve it, but Centoleri is the real thing. It's
and
on
yes.
upper Madison Avenue,
and we're going to pop in and see you one
Absolutely.
Of these days, and we also want to know when you find another space and open another restaurant.
It will be my pleasure to let you know first.
Okay, Pino.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, and if you let me know when this thing is going to be in the internet, I would very much love to hear it.
Well, that's great. Okay, ciao.
Ciao, thank you.
Thank you, Pino.
Bye.
Well, Pino certainly is something else. Peter calls him a serial entrepreneur.
Serial. It's spelled, of course, C-E-R-E-A-L.
and we can hardly wait to see where he's going.
Yeah, he's going to have another couple of restaurants in New York, as he forecasts, as I'm sure you can tell. And the man has absolutely boundless energy. I don't really know how he does it.
I don't either. But anyhow, that wraps it, I guess, for another week.
That wraps New York for the time being. Pino Longo was included because...
Well, we do New York next week, too, we're going to be doing, aren't we?
Are we going to be doing New York? No, we're not. Well, we're in New York next week, but we're in New York next week for a very special event to do with wines from Italy. So although the site is New York City, the subject is something different. Big, big program. If you ever wanted to know anything about the top wines of Italy, this is a program that you really must listen to, because it's not only wine experts talking about Italian wines, but winemakers themselves talking about their wines, and in particular celebrating our early tasting of the 2004 vintage of the wonderful Italian white wine Brunello di Montalcino. So you wine mavens, this is marketing your calendar. It's one that you just absolutely must listen to. And in the meantime, between now and then, we hope you'll have a wonderful week, and we wish you the very best.
Bye-bye.